Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moscow Wayne. It's undoubtedly one of the top images of 2019. 16-year-old Greta Thunberg, clad in a black all-weather jumpsuit, standing atop the deck of a sailboat as it enters a marina in South Manhattan in late August, 15 days after it had set sail from Europe. Thunberg was making a point. She made the transatlantic trip by sailboat because air travel emits an enormous amount of carbon dioxide, and elevated CO2 emissions are a main contributor to climate change. Journey by air is increasingly a target of climate activists, but it is also deeply embedded into modern culture. Not only do we fly for pleasure, but a great many of us need to do so for business. So, how do we make our carbon footprint, or perhaps more accurately, our flight print, smaller? Kim Cobb is with us by phone. She is professor of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences and director of the Global Change Program at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Good to have you with us, Kim.
Well, thanks for having me.
And Timothy Searchinger is research scholar at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. He joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Timothy.
Thank you for having me.
And as always, the number to call in is 888-477-9499. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let's begin with a sobering statistic from a paper published a few years ago in the journal Science, which found that one passenger's share of emissions for a 2,500-mile flight, say across the country, equals the melting of 32 square feet of Arctic summer sea ice. And this is just for one seat only on a plane. Kim Cobb, a recent article in the Chicago Tribune about you opens by calling you the Indiana Jones of climate science and goes on to talk about how you've flown to the caves of Borneo to study ancient and current climate conditions. You've jetted to a remote South Pacific island to see the effects of warming on coral and much more. But Kim, at some point you found some serious irony in your work and your time spent in the air, and how all this might affect climate change.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was just quite the journey you outlined there. So for 20 years, I have been working in the deep tropical Pacific to unearth something, information about the past trends and variations in temperatures from these very remote and data-poor regions. And what we have found, of course, is that these extremes are increasing with climate change. And this really came to full view in 2016 when I had the, I suppose, fortune or misfortune of witnessing the wholesale bleaching and mortality of my primary study site, Christmas Island, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, during what was a unprecedented ocean temperature extreme during that El Nino that year. And so I think what that caused me to reflect upon is how out of time we are and how much this has already impacted our planet and, of course, the services that we rely on as humans from that planet. And so I basically did a carbon inventory, recognized that flying was contributing roughly 85% of my own personal carbon footprint, and set about in 2017 to do something about that, and of course have diminished that to the point of today, taking the rather drastic action in 2020 of staying on the ground, but for one flight in service to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change assessment that I'm involved with.
And we'll talk about more about how this might affect your work in a moment, but Timothy Searchinger, you fly a lot for work as well, do you not?
I do, yeah. My focus is global agriculture. And so I'm flying to places where I'm studying, like Colombia or Africa or Asia. And I also do a lot of work in Europe. So, yeah, I'm a terrible flying sinner. I'm basically like Kim, or Kim used to be.
Well, you know, and that's the question. Do we view ourselves as sinners, or do we view this, as Kim, you seem to, as an opportunity to try to do something a little differently with our work in light of the fact that this is getting much more attention? I mean, we've talked about cars and coal and methane in regards to climate change, but has there been much attention paid to flight as a contributor? Kim?
Not really, aside from the isolated individuals like myself who just feel like they're happier when they're not on a plane. They'd rather not fly. But aside from those very, very, very vanishing percentage of Americans, flying is still incredibly popular. It's not easily replaced. We aren't going to have a technology to replace that ease in the very near future. And we haven't invested in the kinds of ground-based infrastructure like rail that would make that transition more seamless. And also the culture of appearing in person, especially in academia, is at such a premium that we haven't really developed the virtual and remote technology that might enable this kind of transition. So the issue is, how can individuals help to accelerate the transition to a lower carbon way of doing business? And that's really where I approach the movement of flying less and my role in it.
Yeah. Well, you're actually doing more work in a remote way, in a virtual way. Is that going well for you as you try to do your job?
Well, yes and no. So in general, I'm able to replace, I would say at this point, the majority of my in-person appearances with remote appearances, and have equipped myself with an amazing webcam and a great microphone to make that a little easier. And unfortunately, though, I still get invitations rescinded when I ask for remote presence and opportunities. And that's still a cost that these early adopters are going to have to bear, unfortunately. But in the meantime, I am meaningfully engaged with large professional societies and here at home at Georgia Tech in thinking about how we could really incentivize and provide support for people who would like to do more of their work online and remote and virtual. So again, that link to the collective action is very important.
Timothy Sturginger, flight shaming has taken off. You're shaming yourself earlier in the show.
Absolutely. But, I'm guilty.
But you know, it's becoming increasingly, I guess we're hearing more about it, in particular in Sweden. How does flight shaming work? I mean, basically, there's more shame associated with flight, so people are flying less in Sweden?
You know, I'm not really an expert on that. I guess that's true if you yep. if you listen to the Greta experience.
Yeah.
And, of course, we should fly. Actually, I have a colleague at who I work very closely with in Sweden, and he has definitely taken that to heart. And we actually got to know each other working in Australia about 6 years ago, 5 years ago. And he tells me he's barely taken a flight, or maybe hasn't taken a flight since. So some people definitely are able to do that. Yeah. The challenge that we all have is there, in many cases, really isn't a replacement. If you're talking to a lot of different people, you're going to the field, for example, there unfortunately isn't a complete replacement for that. Yeah. So that's the challenge.
My understanding is that I think train use is up in Sweden. And again, in Kim Cobb, you know, Sweden has a population of just over 10 million. Not sure that flight shaming would have as much of an effect as it might in this country. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I think there are a couple things baked into that I'd like to point out, which is that people really think about Greta and the fact that she has stopped flying, and your colleague as well, thinking about the rather absolutist frame of just never flying again. And that sounds like very daunting and completely impossible, rightly so, for most people. And so what I think we're talking about when we talk about flying less is thinking about where you might shave off some of those flights that aren't strictly necessary for personal or work reasons, those lower priority flights, and to start with that and see how that feels and reflect on how that sits with you. For me, I started with that, and I quickly felt that that wasn't going to be enough for me personally, and so I've moved down a train of much more dramatic reductions and have, again, recognized a role for working with institutional change in terms of facilitating the choices of people like me as we look towards the future. And so I'd like to just remind the listeners that this is not really an all or nothing. This is a process that begins with the tiniest of steps and can accelerate change. Certainly, we need to advocate for really good rail infrastructure in this country. I go by train to D.C. on a regular basis, and it takes 14 hours. So that's, you know, something I'm willing to do, but, you know, that's just not a tenable option for most folks.
Exactly, not everyone
can do
it. Yeah, and it's also good to know that it's not an all-or-nothing thing, because it can be overwhelming to think that, wow, I've got to stop doing X when, you know, X is, you know, flying is such a an integral part of life, especially if you've got to get out there for business. Let's turn to carbon offsets briefly before we go to the break. Timothy, how do they work?
Well, the basic theory behind carbon offsets usually is that you're going to protect some forest or plant some forest somewhere else, or in other some way try to take carbon out of the air to offset the emissions from, in this case, might be air travel. Offsets can be in other ways. For example, in the early years, a lot of offset credits were taken in Europe for what turned out to be a not particularly legitimate reduction, which was that Chinese companies were claiming that they were going to use a particularly problematic coolant that they were still allowed to use that caused global warming, and they were paid to switch to another one, and it wasn't clear if they really were going to use the bad one in the first place. And that's the challenge with offsets. The challenge with offsets is that the main challenge is you're not really sure if you're paying for something that would have happened otherwise. It's called additionality. Are you doing something additional?
Yeah.
And then there are other issues associated with reforestation. For example, if you reforest some area over here from agricultural land, do you clear additional agricultural land over there? So there's been whether these offsets so far have been beneficial has been debated and unclear. But I do think it's possible in some cases to do offsets that are very real and additional. And an example, which really hasn't happened much but is beginning to happen, would be re-wetting peatlands. So peatlands are these very, very carbon-rich wetlands, and many of them have been drained for agricultural use. And once they're drained, they burn, but even if they don't burn, microorganisms take the carbon in the soil and put it back in the atmosphere at fantastic levels. And you can stop that basically by re-wetting these peatlands. Mm-hmm. And so that is an example of something where we're pretty confident that if someone doesn't pay for it, it's not going to happen, and where you do get additional carbon reductions.
So the concept then is, say I fly a lot for a particular company. The company would purchase carbon offsets, and I'd still keep flying, but then the money from these offsets would go to, say, re-wetting peatlands and ostensibly offset carbon output there.
Exactly.
Okay, but accountability is the big question mark.
Accountability, it's also even kind of conceptually hard in a way. I mean, if you have a limit, so if you had, it's different from a typical so-called cap-and-trade system. So in Europe, utilities are required to reduce their emissions. And if one utility wants to reduce a little less, it can pay another utility to reduce more, and you're pretty certain that you've actually achieved the goal. But when you're paying somebody who doesn't have a requirement, somebody says, well, I'm going to cut down my forest unless you pay me. How do you really know he was going to cut down his forest or that doesn't just shift somebody else cutting down the forest? So that's the challenge with offsets. But I do think in the case of airlines, I think this is where things should go temporarily. It's not as good as not flying, but there's a potential to at least mitigate it somewhat.
Okay, we're going to talk about what JetBlue is doing after the break. We're talking to Timothy Searchinger, if that's correct, of Princeton University, and Kim Cobb of Georgia Tech. Stay with us as Radio Times continues. I'm Mary.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Cummings Jordan, this is Radio Times. Marty has the day off today. Are you willing to fly less to reduce the environmental impact of air travel on climate change? The number is 888-477-9499. Send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Our guests for the next part of this hour, Kim Cobb, Professor of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences and Director of the Global Change Program at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Also, Timothy Searchinger is Research Scholar at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. And we promised to talk about what JetBlue is doing. Kim Cobb, JetBlue is the first airline to announce it is going carbon neutral on domestic flights within the U.S., assuming probably we are talking about carbon offsets here?
Yes, we are. And I think it's a great move. And in fact, it's great that we can have this conversation, in part because they've made this bold statement. And certainly I hope that more airlines take note that aggressive statements about their carbon portfolio going forward is going to be important. And there have been many ways to approach this. One thing to reflect on is, following on what your other guest was talking about, with respect to the transparency and accountability behind these offset efforts. And so kind of digging into this offset market, you kind of quickly realize that it's a kind of a black box. And it's very difficult to understand where those dollars are going and for passengers to feel comfortable that they're really going to where they say they are. They're having the impact that they intend, which is to offset their flight emissions. And so to that point, I think it's important to remember that the social cost of carbon, which is one way of thinking about monetizing carbon from flying, for example, a recent study by my colleague Kate Ricke at University of California, San Diego, notes that that number is closer to $418 per ton of CO2 emitted. That's about $200 for a round-trip flight in the United States coast to coast. And so that we can compare to the dollar amount that JetBlue is probably going to be paying for offsets, which I understand to be closer to $8 per ton. And that's a good number, but that's a far cry from the $418 per ton
Sure.
that the world will bear for every ton of CO2 emitted. And so my own approach to offsetting is to actually pay at that social cost of carbon local organizations that are involved in advancing carbon sequestration through reforestation and afforestation in my area, as well as to think about paying organizations that are focused on social justice and climate justice in my local region so they can see that direct tie for myself. So something for the listeners to contemplate. This is not an easy space, but again, I think the bottom line is JetBlue is making a bold statement and starting a conversation.
Timothy, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I think that's right. So I actually work on global forest protection and agriculture. And offsets in the past have not really been legitimate, in part because if you, for example, just pay to take a piece of agricultural land out of production and you plant trees on it, well, that food has to be replaced somewhere else. And so you can actually even have higher emissions from replacing that food somewhere else. So what you really need to do, and we had a long report called Creating a Sustainable Food Future. There's a short version, too, with the World Resources Institute, the World Bank, and the UN. And what we're recommending is actually something you can call produce and protect, which is that you work with places where you can both increase yields and therefore produce more food in the same land. And then by freeing up land, you can reforest that or protect areas that would otherwise be cleared. So there has been a move in this forest protection business into this space, and that will cost more than $8 a ton. And so so that's getting this right is very important.
It almost sounds as if there's a real need for some sort of governmental, perhaps even UN oversight here, Timothy.
Well, I believe that airlines should be responsible for their carbon footprints, just like everybody else. And while we're moving to find ways of reducing the actual direct emissions from airlines, which ultimately might come from ammonia fuel made with solar power and to some extent electrification for short flights. But while that's happening, offsets are the best thing they can do. But in that case, we need to make sure they're truly legitimate.
Yeah.
And so this is I agree with Kim, this is a move in the right direction, but it's got to be closely scrutinized. In fact, one thing I saw when I saw that announcement yesterday was, I have to look at what those offsets are that are going on.
This brings us to a Facebook comment from Julia. Is there any emerging technology out there to reduce the carbon impact of air travel, perhaps hydrogen-powered planes, using electric power when taxiing on the runway? Kim, have you heard anything about this?
Well, certainly there have already been biofuels that have been injected into the aviation fuel supply in kind of very minor ways so far, but there's real potential to grow that. Right now, the issue is that those remain very expensive. And so, again, I think the issue is when we don't have access to cheap fossil fuels to fuel aviation, we're going to see prices increase for that access to transcontinental flight like this. And so that's really the issue is just the cost. And that's something to reflect on. We're going to see less aviation, less access going forward to the kinds of flights that we now take. And so how can we build a model for increasing remote and virtual presentations, thinking about regional hubs for big conferences, really investing in ground transport that could revolutionize how we think about even medium to long distance travel. This is where we need to be looking. I don't think there's going to be a tech solution to keep aviation at its current rate that's in line with the UN climate targets.
Can I say something? Sure.
Could I agree with that? The one thing I would disagree with there, so I actually, a lot of my papers about biofuels, and I actually think, as a general rule, biofuels increase emissions even more than using fossil fuels. And the reason, so this is a longer discussion, but most analyses of biofuels make a fundamental mistake, which is they treat land as free. So every hectare of land, every acre of land you use to devoting plants for biofuels is an acre that isn't doing something else. Either it's not producing food or it's not storing carbon through forest. And when you look at that opportunity cost, you're better off, much better off, not doing biofuels. So I'm actually quite happy that Virgin is not, it's JetBlue, I'm sorry,
yes.
is not going to be doing the biofuel route. I think in the short run, legitimate offsets are the best way of trying to do something, in addition to traveling less, as Kim says, is the most important thing, air travel less. But I do think down the road, there is a possibility to develop ammonia fuels. And also, I think there will be short-haul trips that are electric.
Mark sends us an email saying, I'm happy to do what I can to reduce my carbon footprint, but sometimes I wonder why the onus is placed on consumers and less on big corporations and governments. Can your guests shed some light on the amount of CO2 emitted by regular people versus governments and corporations? And Kim, not so sure if there's information floating around out there, statistics?
Well, it depends how you draw the boxes. That's a really tough one to answer. You know, if you think about the contributions that oil production is contributing to the greenhouse gas issue, you know, it's like 30% globally. It's a huge source of emissions. But where does all of that petroleum go? Into my car and, into that airplane. And so it's very difficult to draw this box very cleanly in the end of the day. And so that's why I think folks like me are so invested in thinking critically about our own carbon footprints and how we can see the levers to collective scale action that can start to change these things. Obviously, political engagement, if you're concerned about this issue, is key. We're in an election year right now, and we have some very stark choices to make about what kinds of wholesale changes and investments we would like to make in our low carbon future. And so, yes, there are many, many ways to engage, but I think it's kind of an all of the above moment and all hands on deck, and every vote matters and every approach matters and every voice matters. And that's where I approach this, not from an either or, but an and.
Are we getting to that point where there's a sense of urgency of all hands on deck with the climate change issue? What's your sense, Timothy Searchinger?
Well, absolutely. I mean, what you're seeing in Australia is kind of Armageddon. And, there's been this belief that scientists overstate the problem. Scientists are always so concerned about overstating that they tend to understate the problem. And there's always been an emphasis on high risk. And what we're seeing is essentially higher temperatures, temperatures are increasing at the higher end of projections, and the damages are at the higher end of projections. But let me just say one thing. The Mark's question could be viewed another way, which is, what is the importance of personal behavior versus changes in government policy? And ultimately, it's going to have to be changes in government policy that make the change. So it's important
because of the wider impact.
Yeah, the wider impact. And it's just, the reality is that many individuals making some beneficial decisions isn't going to be enough to get the types of change that we need, or to even spur the technological improvements that we need. Mm. The exception, so I think it's important to try to, every person's carbon emissions count. One ton is one ton. But we need massive reductions, basically to zero by 2050. And that's not going to happen without concerted government effort. Now, the one exception, I would say, is where your personal behavior can help spur a kind of a new industry to develop that then offers a technology that governments can take up. So in that space, I actually think plant-based meats really matter. The fact that some people are willing to pay a little bit extra money for that has allowed companies to come into the business that are now making plant-based foods that are basically really good, taste like meat. And a lot of my work is about the importance of beef, and its emissions are higher than usually estimated because people don't count the land use cost of using beef. And so where you have the opportunity through your behavior to help trigger the development of a new technology, that's the place I think you should focus.
Let's get to a provocative quote about personal responsibility from philosopher Walter Sinnott Armstrong. It's about 15 years old, but still I think is relevant. His article was called "It's Not My Fault: Global Warming and Individual Moral Obligations," and he argued that he should be able to take his SUV for a Sunday afternoon drive if he wants, that, you know, quote, no storms or floods or droughts or heat waves can be traced to my individual act of driving. And I'm sure most, if not all, perhaps, of us have at times thought about this. Gee, should I take the car out and take this drive? And yeah, I'm going to go to the beach today, even if you feel a little guilty. What do you think about his particular line of thinking, Kim Cobb?
Well, I think this is an individual and highly personal set of decisions that we each have to make for ourselves in the context of our own lives and our own values. So I think the worst part of all of this discussion is the idea of flight shaming, that somebody can look across look across the room and see somebody who is a frequent flyer and say, shame on you. That's very much, it's so destructive and so divisive as an approach.
And it can backfire.
Yeah, well, certainly, of course, yeah. It can backfire, and I'm sure it does on a daily basis. That's why I really try to message that this is my own personal choice. But to the quote exactly, the reason why I have taken kind of extraordinary measures to think about reducing the carbon emissions in my life, you know, is kind of, for me, a personal journey that I am on, and it's a lifelong one. I try to talk about it and share it. I try to make decisions that I think might have market value, whether it's thinking about an electric car, I'm investing in Amtrak through my train travel, buying plant-based meats, which Tim talked about. All of these things have linkages between our actions and the kind of collective scale movement that we need. The fact of the matter is we can't wait for kind of government-level policy to make us do the right thing. We are out of time. And so we're going to have to meet the demands of lowering emissions, starting with ourselves, our family, our neighbors, our neighborhoods, our city, our state, and eventually our nation when we can get around to it. But we are out of time.
And as far as philosophy is concerned, from the other side, Professor John Nolt of the University of Tennessee tried to calculate the climate impact one American has over the course of his or her lifetime and came up with this. The average American causes through his or her greenhouse gas emissions the serious suffering or even deaths of two future people. So, you know, that's just to get that in from the other side. I'm going to throw something out here, and I'm not sure if it's something that either of you, you know, just kind of has it at your fingertips. But because it's so hard to widely reduce, so challenging to reduce the use of fossil fuel consumption, should we at this juncture be looking more seriously at methods of pulling carbon out of the air?
Well, sure. That is certainly something that we need to be advancing the technologies for doing that. That doesn't mean that that's what you spend money on today to reduce emissions. It's always cheaper to put less carbon in there than to pull carbon out. But we do need to be investing in the technologies that hopefully will be able to do that, particularly direct air capture. And hopefully that will happen, but people, that isn't going to be the silver bullet. It's going to be very likely quite expensive, and it's something that we need to do in addition to doing everything else.
Yeah, that was my next thought. Kim Cobb, a combination perhaps of both a reduction of consumption and trying to get the CO2, at least some of it, out of the air, at least to stabilize the atmospheric situation.
Yes, and I think of this as such a layered problem. We need to get going today with what we know works and can, by the way, fuel our economic growth. For example, energy efficiency. We remain extremely wasteful in this country with energy. We can save ourselves money when we start to wholesale shift to more efficient systems of energy, both through transportation and the grid. But yes, longer term, we are absolutely, I'm convinced, going to turn to these mechanisms of pulling CO2 out of the sky to try to really reverse the warming that we're facing this century, and of course the sea level rise that will come along with it. And so I'd like to point out the work here at Georgia Tech that's going on. These are engineers like Chris Jones, my colleague, who are spending the last decade advancing direct air capture technologies, and they have come so far. And they're thinking about recycling the CO2 that they are pulling out of the sky into a liquid fuel that could run your car. So, yes, all of this is extremely energy intensive. Right now, you basically emit more CO2 than you may capture through this process, and it's very costly. But we need to continue to make deep investments in this kind of technology so that it becomes cheaper and more scalable to meet the challenges of mid-century, when we may very well wake up and say we are willing to pay almost any price to pull CO2 out of the sky and return as closely and fastly as we can to our year 2000 world, if you will. And we're going to need to make those deep investments, and we're not making enough of them right now.
We've
and
only it, got it, oh, go ahead, Timothy.
Yeah. So it's also, though, important to really get this right and not get carried away emotionally. So, for example, there's a lot of focus now on trying to sequester carbon, take more carbon into agricultural soils. And that's very hard to do and uncertain and not very large, probably. By contrast, 0.5% of the world's agricultural land is peatlands, just 0.5%. And they emit on the order of 2% of global emissions. And they're going to continue to emit so long as they're not re-wetted. So if you wanted to do something, it's much easier, not necessarily politically, but technically and economically, much easier to stop emitting from peatlands than to try to sequester carbon in agriculture.
I'm going to have to stop you there. Unfortunately, a multifaceted issue. We'll return to it at some point down the road. Timothy Serchinger, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Kim Cobb as well. Kim Cobb of Georgia Tech, Timothy Serchinger of Princeton University. Stay with us. We'll be talking to travel writer Seth Kugel after the break. This is Radio Times. You are listening.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
To Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. This hour, we've been talking about climate change, and in particular, how air travel contributes to climate change. So what's a person to do if they've been planning a fabulous trip to Europe, or say they have business in California? Seth Kugel is a travel writer, the former New York Times frugal travel columnist. He's also the host of the Amigo Gringo YouTube channel and author of Rediscovering Travel, a guide for the globally curious. And he joins us now to share his thoughts. Hi, Seth.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. And as always, if our listeners would like to join the conversation, it's 888-477-9499. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send along an email to radiotimes@whyy.org. Seth, you've traveled, obviously, for a living, and you write recently that you grew steadily uneasier about travel since ending a stint as the frugal traveler columnist for the New York Times, as back in 2016. What changed for you?
Well, I think as we continue to look at all the ways that our carbon footprint impacts the environment, I'm talking about eating less meat and driving fewer places, I would always be thinking, like, what would it be like to work for an oil company right now and feel guilty just going to work? And then I kind of realized that the travel industry is basically part of the oil industry, or the fuel, the fossil fuel industry. And so I just began to think about it in those terms, the same way I think about what I eat and, what light bulbs my house uses.
What do you think of the flight shaming phenomenon?
You know, when I looked into this, I think that, I guess it was Kim that was saying, it's not a really effective way to promote this kind of change, to shame other people, right? I think she had the right idea. There are some studies that have been done that show that shaming people does not produce good results and does, in fact, often backfire. There's a place called the Center for Climate Change Communication at George Mason University. I spoke to somebody there who was explaining this to me. So I think it is more about, well, first of all, it's about what you can do as an individual. And then I think it's about how you can work to change the system. I mean, you know, maybe the biggest thing you could do right now to impact the environment is who you vote for president. There's a million. This is a very multifaceted issue, of course, and you do need to work on your own issues and your own use. But you also need to look at where you fit in, where you're donating money, where you're volunteering, that sort of a thing.
And actually, you have written, you know, when it comes to thinking about, say, that dream trip to Italy, no self-flagellation required. Although there's also introspection someplace in the equation, right?
Sure. I mean, I think we need to think about, you know, I'm a meat eater and I've been reducing my meat to one meal a day, you know, and I think we need to sort of do the same thing for travel. If it's something that you love to do, that's an incredibly important part of your life, then you need to continue to do it, but you need to be thoughtful about how you do it. I don't think anybody these days should be running around the world trying to count how many countries they've been to. If your dream is to go to Italy and you've been saving up for years, then you should go. If your dream is to set foot in, you know, all 200 and something nations that are part of the United Nations, I think you need to think about that dream again. People should not be going to 2 days for one city and then flying to another city and then flying to another city. You can easily make a more environmentally responsible trip by going to fewer places for longer periods of time, and all other things being equal, going to closer places rather than further places. I think I talked in that same article about how it's hard to understand why someone would go from the United States, say, to the Maldives or to Fiji if they're just looking for a beach vacation when we have the Caribbean just a couple hours flight away.
Mm. Well, sometimes, obviously, there's the exotic nature, which is the lure, and the thought that, oh, you know, I might be lying on some gorgeous beach with a fun beverage, and perhaps if you've been to the Caribbean, which is a little closer a number of times, then, you know, I mean, the adventure in a person says, well, I'd love to do this. I want to see this before. It's on my bucket list. I mean, what would you do to reconcile that with trying to be environmentally conscious?
Well, the first thing is I'm very anti-bucket list. I don't think that that's a useful way to think about travel. Maybe if you designed a bucket list to be about experiences rather than about being places and ticking off boxes. I personally, you know, I'm not a huge beach person, but I don't really think there's any lack of stuff to do in different islands to see and different cultures to experience in the Caribbean that would force someone to go to the Maldives. Now, if you're a diver or something and you're looking to see a certain exotic fish, fine. I'm sorry, I may have forgotten the question.
my train jumps the tracks all the time, Seth. I'm with you on that. You're also not much of a fan of travel influencers who might, you know, kind of put a little pressure on others who don't go with the program they think is important. So really, we have to take maybe a step back of instead of following the leader, you know, what we think we need to do for travel, just really take a little time to reflect.
Right. I mean, I think that we need to look at who we're following. There's a huge number of people out there, once again, who are showing off about how they're going to visit every country in the world. I think those are not the people we should be following. Instead of asking how many countries you've been to, ask about, you know, how well do you know a specific culture? How many languages do you speak? There's plenty of substitutes for travel, or for at least that kind of travel, that are just as good, if not better. And then, of course, infiltrating the influencer world is the travel industry. You know, when you see an influencer on YouTube or you know, on Instagram or something like that, glorifying a certain place, you know, there's a pretty good chance that there's some corporate money or some government tourism ministry money going into that trip. So we do need to be very careful about what we consume. Travel writing and producing travel content is very expensive.
Yeah.
So it's certainly understandable that there would be some cooperation between the industry and travel writers and travel content producers. But I think we need to be very careful, and really responsible content producers label that very clearly, so you know it's just not them sitting on in a gorgeous hotel room in a gorgeous beach, showing specifically something that some company is trying to get them to show.
Mm. So be more thoughtful. Seth Kugel, you know, as a travel writer, you know, give us an idea of where you might be headed in the near future and how you are making this work with, consciousness about preserving our atmosphere and doing something to help thwart increasing climate change.
Well, one thing is people are very surprised to hear, for example, that I've never been to Southeast Asia or India in my life, even in 5 years of writing the Frugal Travel Columnist. Before that, I was more of a Latin America specialist, and since then, I've kind of decided, like, I don't need to go. I'm not going to actively seek to see that part of the world. I'm going to try to travel more locally, travel more. I do travel by bus. I gave up my car. So I live in New York City, so it's a little easier to give up your car. But I travel by bus when I go to see my family who lives in Boston and Washington. I still do travel a couple of times a year to Brazil. My YouTube channel is sort of based in Brazil, and it's mm-hmm. about Brazil. So that's a business need, but I try to go for longer. Instead of going 6 times a year for a week, I would go twice a year for 3 weeks or something like that. So that's just the beginning. I have a lot to go to. This is something I'm just going through right now. And I'm also, you know, personally trying to transform the journalism I do from traveling and writing about it to writing about traveling and thinking about these kinds of issues.
When you travel by bus, do you make a point of choosing lines that are employ quote unquote cleaner technology?
I probably should, but usually the places that I'm going when I are very specific, and there's usually only one or two lines that go. But one of the things I definitely recommend everybody do is do that, not just for bus companies, but for airlines as well. One of the things you want to look out for bus companies as well is how well they treat their drivers. Not everything is an environmental issue. It could be the cleanest buses ever, but their drivers could be breaking all kinds of laws by how many hours they stay on the road. So
there's a safety issue
there's
too.
There's a lot of cultural aspects, labor aspects, and environmental aspects to sustainable travel. It's not just about the environment, although I think that's probably the biggest piece.
So along the lines of substituting cleaner forms of travel, you've said, you know, if you still have to fly, if you want to go to Europe, once you get there, you don't have to fly around Europe. You can mm-hmm. take the train. Tell us about that experience. It's a slower way to go, and we are still used to being go, 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 you know, because we've got itineraries. Give us a plug for train travel.
Sure. Travel is about the experience, not about being in one place and getting to another place. And being on a train is great for any number of reasons. I took one trip by train across the United States, well, really from Texas, and ended up in Washington. And it's amazing how many people you meet in the train. It's incredibly social. You see the actual landscape that you're going by. If you plan it right, you can stop in 5 different cities without impacting, you know, there's absolutely no difference whether when you hop off the train somewhere and get right back on it. The train doesn't have to take off again like an airplane does, you know, use a lot of fuel that way. And train is romantic. And let's face it, like short discount budget airlines, especially in Europe, but also in the United States, are really unpleasant experiences. You know, there are people who will want to spend $50 to fly somewhere and then end up paying $50 just for an Uber to get out to the crazy airport they have to go to take the flight. And then, you know, that kills their whole day anyway. Train travel is just far more pleasant It's their greater experiences. You have more stories to tell. I mean, most stories that we come back from travel with don't happen when we're like, visiting the Vatican or something like that. They happen on trains. They happen on route places. They happen while we're waiting for the bus. They happen someone, you know, you met while hiking, that sort of a thing. So I think we just need to rethink a little bit what we think travel is. And it's really not about a bucket list and seeing, you know, very specific things. It's about experiences. It's about meeting people. It's about getting to know other cultures. And if we think about it that way, that's a really good argument for getting to know our own cities and the various immigrant groups that are in those cities. That's a good way to travel without traveling. And then staying in specific places for longer.
And at the end of the day, it can really help the environment as far as climate change is concerned. We've got a question from Caroline who asks, what does your guest think about ecotourism? What do you think, Seth?
Well, I mean, that is sort of what we're talking about. There's different definitions of ecotourism, but what I she's probably referring to like resorts that are eco-resorts, and usually those are very, very expensive. So that's a great option for people that have that kind of money to spend on travel. I think in many ways, very budget travel is also eco-friendly. I mean, when I was traveling as Frugal Traveler, I'd get to a place, I'd take public transportation everywhere, I'd take buses, I'd try to stay with people in their houses rather than using a hotel room and all the resources that hotels use. I try not to use sort of the services specifically made for tourists. So that's a different form of ecotourism. Eco-resorts can be great, but also there's a lot of greenwashing, and you really need
what
to
is
look
greenwashing?
Very carefully make sure.
What is greenwashing?
Greenwashing is when you sort of pretend to be environmentally conscious to attract business, but you're really just sort of doing it for show.
So you favor less touristy areas. Take us off the beaten path and tell us how that might, you know, benefit the environment in doing so.
It doesn't just benefit the environment. It also this cultural impact of tourism as well, including over-tourism in certain cities that have sort of lost their livability, like Barcelona and Lisbon. But certainly environmentally, if you blend in as much as you can with sort of the local way of doing things, then you are less impactful on the environment. So if you're, if you go to fly to Paris and then, you know, take a taxi around Paris and then go to stay in a really nice hotel, which uses a lot of, you know, whatever, towels and hot water and everything like that. That's a lot different from, I don't know, going to a small town in Hungary and doing a homestay and, driving around with a family or something like that.
For a great many of us, you know, traveling, you know, for pleasure is a privilege that's not shared by a vast number of people across the globe. And you do address this.
I mean, that's a great point. A lot of times we've come to think of travel as like a right, like, oh, this is a part of our modern living. This is like, I must travel. You see these like sayings on Facebook posts and whatever about how travel is just such an important part of people's lives. But the vast majority of people in the world don't travel. And in fact, one thing I don't think anybody's spoken about this hour is how increasing travel in China and India is going to impact all this. I mean, people in the United States could stop traveling entirely, and the increased travel by the Chinese and Indian middle classes would just make up for it in 2 seconds.
So in terms of what? A negative impact environmentally and also on those who are less privileged? Making up for what as a rich country in the United States as opposed to China and India? Is that the point?
No, I guess the point is that we need to, this is a larger problem. It's not just enough to, basically, these are countries where people have never traveled or large numbers of people have never traveled from that are starting to travel.
Okay.
It's just, I'm basically expressing more of a problem than a solution. Like what we need is sort of worldwide change in travel, in technology, to have a real impact. Because, you know, it's just like if everyone in Sweden stopped traveling, that would be great. But then if travel increases everywhere else, that's just not. I think we just have to stop thinking of travel as a right that we have and start thinking of it more as like you said, a privilege or a thing that we get to do, or that only very, very lucky people get to do and should take responsibility for.
Seth, got about 10 seconds. A follow-up question from Caroline, who asks, how can you tell if something's greenwashing or authentically eco-friendly? 10 seconds.
Sure. Yeah, there's a lot of organizations out there that rate and sort of give green stamps to organizations. So you want to try to look and see whether the place you're going has been certified by an organization that does that sort of thing, and then look up the organization, make sure they're legit.
Seth Kugel, great to have you with us once again for Radio Times.
Thanks.
Seth is a host of the Amigo Gringo YouTube channel and the author of Rediscovering Travel. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks, as always, for joining us for Radio Times.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance, like your first home expansion or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.